Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest this morning is Laura Duckstar. She is the best-selling author and speaker and a visionary. Laura is sought-after speaker and has been featured in many national and local publications, including USA Today, the Miami Herald, The Sun Sentinel, and Writer Magazine. The message of her first book, I Love You More, captures the power and magic of unconditional love shared between the mom and a child, sold over 225,000 copies in 2007. Her mission is to generate the conversation of love around the world. According to Laura, I knew from a very young age that I was meant to travel the world, meet my brothers and sisters, and share the message of love. Nothing I love more than sharing my story so that others might see that no matter what challenges they are facing, anything is possible with love. She's here to talk about her life's journey, her best-selling book, I Love You More, and her mission and passion about spreading unconditional love worldwide. Good morning, Laura. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you?
Very good, Johnny. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Really enjoyed reading your book. It's a wonderful book. It's beautifully put together, very attractive. But most importantly, what I really liked about it is the message itself, I love you more. And what I'd like to get started this morning is to talk about your life's journey. Laura, please tell us about your childhood, your family, and the community you grew up in.
Yeah, I think that that's where it all began. And I would say I wish I appreciated a little bit more how I grew up and the love that I really had present. I wish that I had a little bit more awareness of that love as I was growing up that was actually there. And I really want to acknowledge you and the awareness and the experience that you have of your mother's love, mother's plural. And it's really a beautiful gift that you've been given to really be present to that love, you know, that you, you know, had as a child and in all your years since. My childhood started on the seashore, on the south shore of Boston, so about halfway between Boston and the Cape. And I grew up on the ocean. My grandparents owned a restaurant and hotel, Italian steak and seafood, and then there were two floors above it that were rooms right on the coast. And I grew up in the house behind that. And I grew up in a big extended Italian and Greek family, where we had, you know, incredible holiday meals together. Mm-hmm. And when we were all old enough, the 10 grandchildren, not all of us, but a lot of us, worked at the restaurant and hotel. And it was really an incredible extended family experience that we had. My mom has three sisters, so there's four daughters, and then 10 grandchildren. And then even a larger extended family of all the young people that would come and work there during the summer. It was a big summer town right there on the ocean. And it was an awesome experience. Now, I would find myself, I loved when I was a kid to walk, and I didn't know why I loved this so much, but I loved walking, and I would often find myself, some may think that I was a little bit crazy, but I would find myself singing the song, Love is in the Air, and I had a real strong connection to St. Francis, and I remember now being about 7 or 8 years old and walking for miles on the beach, and singing that song, Love is in the Air, and thinking that one day I was going to travel the world and meet my brothers and sisters and spread the message of love. So that vision has pretty much come true.
That's fantastic. You know, I actually, my foster Italian mom in Papa Bluff, Missouri, they own restaurants, and Italian restaurants, so I could certainly relate to the opportunity to be in a restaurant, a family restaurant business and everything else, because I would help them out during the holiday seasons away from college and help with the restaurants and everything else. And I remembered during the holidays, we would make our own homemade muffaladas. and Italian sausage and everything else. So the next question for me, you know, from me to you is that I presume you were an excellent chef or cook of Italian foods.
One would think, Johnny, but one might be mistaken. There's a and it's funny because I can. So my papa was 100% Italian, and he married a Greek, 100% Greek, and her family really pretty much disowned her because Greeks and Italians didn't marry back then. A very interesting story that would fill up a whole other show, but she was one of 8 children, and her mother died giving birth to her youngest brother.
Yeah.
And so she was the oldest daughter, so she really raised her brothers and sisters, and then when she went and married this Italian, they for about 2 years, they basically disowned her. You know, wild. But what I was going to share about that is that my grandfather was the cook. He did the cooking. My Nana, she wasn't like almost not even allowed to cook until the day he died. And then it was amazing. It was like she could cook everything that he cooked as good, in some cases better. And talk about like, you know, motherly love being present in the kitchen. So she didn't cook until then. And now there's the 4 daughters. You know, they're all in their 60s, about 60 to 70 years old now.
Yeah.
And they are the cooks. Now, there's a couple of the grandchildren that are good cooks, but I can't claim that I'm one of them. The holidays are still ruled by that next generation, the older generation. When we get together, they're the ones in the kitchen, and they just don't make a lot of – well, either I could say they haven't given us the room in the kitchen yet or that we haven't gotten in there and claimed our space yet. But I know that it's inherently in me, just hasn't started shining through yet.
I see. Well, I can certainly understand that because, I mean, I learned how to cook out of necessity, you know, the need to survive. But, later I enjoyed cooking because it was kind of interesting. And then, of course, the conversations that that came out of it because I turned everything into something positive in the sense that, hey, it teaches me to stay in the now, so to speak, because when you're cooking, you can't really let your mind run wild because you have to focus on the things that you have to do. So that's kind of interesting. Are you still, I know you live very close with all your family members and everything else, so I presume you guys still get together on the weekends perhaps or the holidays for a big meal?
We get together very often. My sister lives very nearby with her 4 children. And people often ask me if I have children of my own, especially because of the book and the message that I was able to bring into the world. And I don't. The book was actually written for my sister and my oldest nephew, but they live nearby. And now with her fiance and his 2 children, there are 6, 8 of them. And I have a dear aunt and cousin who live nearby. And my mom's down. I live in South Florida. My mom's down by me most of the time now. And we get together to celebrate birthdays and holidays and just all kinds of special occasions. So we really do spend a lot of family meal time still together.
That's really good because I think sometimes because of work and everything else, and of course now the world is, we are living in a global village. So nothing happens without us being able not to travel all over the place. And then what happens is that we live in a closed system, so we all scattered in some ways, and we need special occasions to draw us back together. And in your case, what's good about it, you guys are, living fairly close by to one another. You went through a tremendous challenge at the age of 11, that is losing your hair. How did this change your view about life at that time?
Yeah, I always say that I love doing radio shows, and I've done maybe hundreds of them, but what your listeners can't see is that I'm completely bald, so they can't hear that. And so at the age of 11, I had long brown wavy hair, and it did start falling out in about a nickel size and then quarter size patch. And within about, I don't know if I want to say about 6 months, it was to the point that I was, I was an 11-year-old with a really bad comb over and needed to go and get wigs. Well, that's what we decided to do. My mom had brought me, finally we got the diagnosis that I had a condition called alopecia areata, which they believe is stress triggered, and there's not really, they don't really know what to do about it. There, because it's not a, you know, fatal or terminal, there's not a lot of money put into, you know, trying to cure it. And so the advice that my mother had gotten, which she really knew wasn't great advice, but the doctor actually said, you know, there's really nothing we can do. Get a wig and you don't have to tell anyone. Mm-hmm. And my mom knew inherently as a mom that, you know, that's not the thing to do, but
yeah.
that was fine with me. excuse me for a second. I got a wig and I became so introverted. Johnny, everybody that knows me now says I'm making up for lost time because I just shut down. I didn't want to say the word wig. I didn't want to share with anybody about it. I didn't want to talk about it. And for 10 years, and I know that this is really hard for anybody to imagine, but for 10 years, from the time that I was 11 and I put that first wig on to the time I was 21 years old, I never looked at myself in a mirror without a wig on.
Wow.
So, you know, if I went to the wig shop or I went to the doctor's, I made sure that I went in. Some of the wig shops didn't even have dressing rooms at that point, but I would go, like, into, like, a back closet or a storage room.
Wow.
And it would change. I just really felt like there was something wrong with me. And I don't know what I thought lived underneath that wig, but I was sure that I didn't want to see it. And it wasn't until I was in college, from the time I was in elementary school when I lost my hair to the time I was in college, and someone that I was dating at the time actually said, you know, I had gotten to the point then that I could at least talk about it with people that I was close with. And he said, you know, can I see you without your wig on? And I remember taking it off for the first time and kind of crying for what seemed to be hours before I made my way over to the mirror. And now I'll remember forever that dorm room and looking in the mirror and being like, oh, it's really not that bad. But then it was still another 10 years until I made my, you know, my kind of like next life-changing decision.
Now, I mean, it's sometimes in life we go through those tremendous challenge, but I think what's interesting also, I think during that period of time, I can just visualize myself, it must be really challenging, not only for you, I mean, as a young child and thinking, you know, of course, you have all this peer pressure, but I'm sure for your mom.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing that people don't realize because you are her heart and her soul.
Yeah.
And thinking that, oh my God, there's nothing I can do to wave a magic wand to change anything. And I'm sure that had been a tremendous challenge for her. And how was that relationship evolve over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I sometimes, I don't know that I joke, because a lot of times it does really feel like the experience of having a child, my experience of having a child is my book and bringing that, kind of like birthing that message into the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have children of my own. And I would almost even say that the experience might have been more difficult for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I pulled away a lot from my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled away from everybody. I just pulled away from life during this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So over the last maybe like 10 years, mm-hmm. I've really recreated my relationship with my mom
mm-hmm.
and really been able to let her love me and
mm-hmm.
really love her back
mm-hmm.
in a way that was probably very much missing during this, you know, difficult time in our lives that we experienced.
And that's got a lot to do, too. I mean, I realize what you're talking about where subconsciously, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, we pull away from our moms, because I go through that from a standpoint of not necessarily, you know, as drastic as what you're talking about, but certainly for me was more about the fact that I was adopted at childbirth and then realizing later that I was adopted and maybe why I wasn't wanted by my maternal parents, so to speak, mom or whatever. But then after hearing the story, but still there's a time where you go through and you think, but it's a totally two different scenarios here, but it's that low self-esteem within ourselves that actually drew us away. And then as we find our center, which I'm sure you had experienced that over the years, and that you had mentioned, because then you find that, wow, when you look back, and it's like it's a wonderful reconnection. And the unique thing about it, Laura, I believe that it was never a disconnect. There may be a prolonged time out,
yeah,
but it was never a disconnect. And that's the uniqueness about, you know, about motherly love and what you mentioned about, and I love you more because of that unconditional love. It may be stretched, it may be twisted, but it is never disconnected.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I really saw that you expressed that really beautifully in your book From My Mama's Kitchen, in that a mother's love is always there. And sometimes it looks really different than what you would expect it to look like. And sometimes the experience, the physical experience is very different. But deep down, and whether it's on the mother's side or the child's side, there really never is a complete disconnect. That
right.
There's just an inherent love there that, you know, underneath any circumstances still lives and still has the ability to, rebirth or reawaken.
Right.
And we can't judge what it's supposed to look like. You know, I don't want to necessarily need to use the word fairy tale, but there is ideal situations of what we believe a mother's love looks like.
Right.
But really, a mother's love looks like all the different ways that a mother's love looks in this world. And all these experiences that we're having, we're meant to be having, and they're serving, you know, and my belief, like those souls' evolutions and whatever ways that they're meant to be served. That was a big thing for me. People say, like, well, you know, do you wish that your life had, you know, that you had never lost your hair?
Yeah.
And I always, for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
I knew that I would never change this experience that I've had.
Right.
Because I've learned to become a big believer in that our biggest challenges become our biggest blessings. And almost the bigger the challenge, the bigger the blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that I dealt with, there's a lot of children that have alopecia areata, and they deal really wonderfully with it.
Mm-hmm.
They do talk about it. They're able to wear wigs when they want to wear wigs, and
mm-hmm.
they wear a scarf or go bald when they want to go on a roller coaster or do gymnastics or swim. It was like, you know, I just decided to stop doing all of those things. But my experience was almost, you know, you could say it was like I dealt with it in the worst possible way,
mm-hmm.
but it really helped me, come to a greater awareness or a greater understanding about life, my spiritual path and journey,
mm-hmm.
And just my compassion and understanding for, you know, myself and humanity, for that
mm-hmm.
matter. So I'm grateful in that sense for the experience.
I believe so. I mean, I believe it's reflective at a very young age for you. Even when you were in college, apparently you got a degree from University of Maryland in sociology. So you sort of became a champion for, I wouldn't say, for lack of a better term, the underdogs, but the ones that's perhaps least understood. Perhaps would you comment on that?
I think, you know, from a very young age, or when I lost my hair, it was I could be a champion for everyone else besides myself. So I couldn't understand why there was racism in the world. I was like, are you, you know, I just didn't understand how somebody could be judged by the color of their skin or their ethnicity. And then when I got to college, I had a roommate who was, I never grew up feeling like I couldn't do something because I was a woman or a girl. I went to an all-girls private Catholic high school, and so, you know, we were well-educated, and it wasn't – but she had experienced that, and so she introduced me to all the different ways and places, especially around the world, that women were suffering and being held down, and so I became a champion for that cause. And then slowly I was able to, through, you know – being a champion for others, I was able to begin to embrace, you know, my own self and self-awareness. But yeah, and I loved that study of sociology and just why things are happening the way that they're happening and why people act and be the way that they are.
Did you change your major when you first started out, or did you just sort of like went into that route, or you know, you switched in the middle?
I did. I actually started out at Boston College as a finance and marketing major,
mm-hmm.
and really only completed my the core courses
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
But I had taken a philosophy and theology class that BC offered together called Pulse, which
mm-hmm.
was 6 hours in the classroom and 6 hours of community service. And it was really the first time that I had done community service like that, and I worked in a school.
Mm.
And my dad was an accountant,
mm.
and my mom was a kindergarten teacher. And I always thought my mother was crazy and my father was, you know, doing something that made a lot more sense. And after doing this course and working in this school with kids who had been kicked out of the public school system, and now this was their kind of their last chance to not be kicked out of the school system altogether, I just said, wow, I have to do something different with my life, something that's going to get me out there in the world and making a difference for children especially. And so I transferred to University of Maryland, changed my degree to sociology, and really I think it wasn't only just wanting to change my major at that point,
mm-hmm.
it was wanting to have a different world experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, you know, I'd grown up in Boston. Almost all of my brother's school had gone to BC. A lot of my school had gone to BC. So it was very much more of the same. And I wanted to experience something different. So it was fantastic going to school so close to Washington, D.C. and all the different marches and speakers that were available to us, and it really gave me a different experience of life.
Now, you did do some, you know, different things in your life, and one of the things that you did was you were a bartender for a brief period of time. How was that like, and what sort of knowledge and experience did you gain from it?
Yeah, I guess we all have a different definition of brief. My mother wouldn't call. I don't know that my mom refers to my six-year stint in South Beach as brief. I had graduated from college and thought that I would take 3 to 6 months off before going back to get my master's and moved to Miami, to South Beach, with my cousin. And 6 years later, I was still bartending and had not gone back to get my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, almost, you know, clearly waking up one day and saying, wow, this isn't what I meant to do with my life. You know, what am I going to do? Because I didn't go back to school and I'm not working inside of my degree. Now, my mom jokes that my degree's in sociology, and
mm-hmm.
I moved to South Beach and practiced being social. So, and in a way, there's some truth there. I think that
mm-hmm.
my time there did serve as a, it was a pretty crazy time, but it was also a time where I made a lot of friends and really let people in to
mm-hmm.
my life in a way that I hadn't before.
Mm-hmm.
I was also working right on Ocean Drive, at really one of the busiest places in the country, basically, and I worked with people and met people every day from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I really love about bartending and waitressing, and, you know, depending on where you're working, but you're always meeting new people, and that, you know, and I did grow up, as I had already shared, in a restaurant, so I was very comfortable
mm-hmm.
in that type of place. So not only did I bartend, but I also managed the restaurant and bar, and but that was never quite as much fun. actually, the bartending. So it was a crazy time in my life. But it also really let me know that I really enjoyed being with people from all over the world and having that opportunity to connect with all different types of cultures and people. So now I'm doing that in different ways these days. And then now I'm pouring love into the world rather than pouring drinks into the world.
Now, you did, because of that, too, I think it was during that period of time that you did a major paradigm shift at 30. And please share that with us, because I believe, you know, in reading your bio, I think to me that's certainly one of the most important decisions you made in your life's journey.
Yeah, that was really the next major decision that I made. I shared that in college, you know, I finally took my wig off for the first time, but I quickly put it back on. And it was 10 years later about, it was my 30th birthday. And all of a sudden it seemed like out of nowhere, but I had already had the idea for the book. So it seemed like out of nowhere, but I think it was I actually know that it was a direct result of having the idea for the book. That about 2 weeks before my 30th birthday, I said, you know what, I'm not going to wear wigs anymore. I called up a couple of my really close friends and I said, guys, throw me a birthday party. We had two choices of nightclubs in New York City. It was going to either be at Life or Chaos. I always say that both of them made sense, but we chose Life. And we had a big party, and people came from all over the country, and I had my coming out party as the bald chick.
Oh.
And I decided that I was no longer going to wear wigs, and now it's been 11 years of having this experience, and it's gone through different phases for sure. At the first couple of years, it was really this whole new experience of being in the world like this, and it was getting used to people staring or pointing or asking questions. And then what's interesting, and people ask me this a lot, over time,
mm-hmm.
there is less people staring and pointing. Now, sometimes there is still,
mm-hmm.
but what I fully believe is that as I've become more comfortable
mm-hmm.
with who I am,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I say that it took me I learned that lesson, just be yourself, many
mm-hmm.
years ago, and
mm-hmm.
it took me many, many, many years to embrace it or actually be that that expression. And once I learned to do that, then as I'm comfortable with myself, the world around me is comfortable.
Right.
So, you know, if I'm having a day where I'm feeling a little insecure on the inside, then that's probably the day when somebody, you know, walks by me and giggles or points.
That's correct.
And for the most part, and the phenomena is that people will say, like, you know, oh my God, Laura, once you sit down and start talking to you for like 5 minutes, you forget that you don't even have hair.
Mm-hmm.
And they're surprised that they don't, you know, that it's not even like in their awareness anymore. And
right.
It's just because I've really so integrated into this is who I am.
And that's the aura that you put out too, and it's very, very true, because what people feel and see is that energy around you. And as you evolve from within, because I know certainly we all go through this period about, there's nothing wrong with me, it's everything wrong around the whole world. We want to change the world. But I think as we find the answer from within, then the world around us, for lack of a better term, doesn't really change. We're able to see what it is for what it is, and it's all about us. And as you found comfort, and certainly that's a major personal paradigm shift to me, that was a unique experience that you have. What inspires you to write I Love You More?
Yeah. Well, it was actually during my bartending days, so I am thankful for them. I was away with a group of friends at the opening of a nightclub in Hartford, Connecticut. One of my friend's brothers was opening up a club,
mm-hmm.
and my sister was pregnant with her second child.
Mm-hmm.
She had had her first child out of wedlock and then got married and now was pregnant with her second child, and her and her husband were having some real problems. And
mm-hmm.
she called me and said, you know, we got into a big fight and he moved out.
Mm.
And now I shared that I live close by to her, but I was away. And so I couldn't do what I would typically do, which would be, you know, no matter what time of the night it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, pick up my things and drive to her house. So what I felt like I could do was pray.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I hadn't prayed like that in a long time. I just really started praying for my sister, like, dear God, please, mm-hmm. take care of my sister and her, you know, her baby and this one on the way. And Johnny, I mean, it was the most surreal experience that I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, this is kind of strange. I don't really pray like this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And something clearly answered me and said, your sister's fine. Pray for your nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, this is even stranger because not only do I not pray like this, but something now just clearly answered me.
Mm-hmm.
So I did as I was told. I don't know that I always, I should probably make a note of that. But I did as I was told, and I started praying for my nephew. And as I did, the whole idea for this book began flooding my being. Now, you have to know, I didn't keep a journal. I didn't consider myself a writer. I never aspired to be an author, but I knew that this was a book that was pouring through me. I mean, if when we recreate it for like a Hallmark or a Lifetime movie, it was just that sense of like white light and energy just flooding through, not even just into my head, but into my heart.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that I got up and I pulled out a piece of, I couldn't sleep. I was, you know, I had to get up and write the ideas down. And I got up and pulled out a piece of hotel stationery and started writing the ideas down. And a friend of mine woke up and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing a children's book. And the whole next day, the whole next year, actually, I spoke about this book like it was something that I knew I had to make happen, but I had no idea, Johnny, how to be an author, what this looked like. But over that, you know, about a year went by, and then I really started taking action to bring the book and its message into the world.
You got some wonderful coaching, though. I mean, you've met John DeMartini, who was featured in The Secret, as your first mentor. How did you meet him?
Yeah, I always say now, and I share a little bit, but that prayer it changed my life, and it led me to everywhere that I needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those places was I started working. Actually, one of my first mentors, I said on one day, and I hate to admit this, but I was probably recovering from a hangover on the couch, and I said, there must be something better to do with my life. And, you know, I'm a big believer, I guess, in that when you ask for something, be sure to listen for the answer, because a lot of times an answer is given, and I don't know if we just don't always hear it or we don't listen, but I said that, and I started flipping through the channels on television. Now, I know some people might say, you know, you would think maybe when you asked a question like that that you would have been prompted to get up off the couch,
no.
But I don't know. I flipped through the stations on the TV and I found Wayne Dyer speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never heard of him before. And I said, oh my God, this is what I was talking about. I was so resonated with the message that he was sharing. It was many years ago. This was 1999, or maybe actually the end of 98.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sharing about his book, The Wisdom of the Ages, which is a beautiful book filled with quotes and stories from great teachers all the way back, you know, to before Christ, A.D. times, and then into, more present teachers like Emerson and Thoreau. And he was sharing, and I was like, oh, this is what I meant. And so that led me to a place called the Science of Mind Center to see him speak in Fort Lauderdale, which also led me to a thing called the Whole Life Expo. I had found the last flyer that was promoting this thing, this event, and it had people like Deepak Chopra and Marianne Williamson and Neil Donald Walsh and Wayne Dyer were all going to be speaking at this event. And they had something inside of it that said, and actually, I have to share that I went to see Wayne Dyer speak, and I wasn't working at the time. I just stopped wearing wigs not too long ago, and now I went to see him speak, and I went with $26 bills and $9 in change to buy my $35 ticket. I really gave, like, the last of what I had to go and surrendered that and had an amazing experience that evening there with him. Then ended up working for this Whole Life Expo, and at the Whole Life Expo, met a gentleman who insisted that I needed to go to this seminar in New York City where John DeMartini was going to be speaking. And I just, it did not live in my realm of existence that I was going to get on a plane and travel to New York from Florida to do a seminar. Now I really enjoy doing seminars about human potential and life development and self-development, but and actually teach them, right? Travel all over the world doing them myself. But at that time, it just didn't exist for me. But he called me enough times that I got on a plane and I went to the seminar that John DeMartini was the keynote speaker at, and he was also doing something that has now become the DeMartini method. And it really has you look to see his mission is very, in some ways, very similar to mine, to bring the experience and the awareness of love into everyone's life, and that it already exists. And it's just a misbalanced perception of the events or the circumstances or the things or the people that we have in our life that we're not seeing the love. And so I did this process with him on everything that had happened to me in my life, from losing my hair to something else that I didn't share with you today, is that my best friend died in a car accident that we were in together when I was 19.
Wow.
But all these things that had happened, we brought love to them. We brought balance. We took the emotional charge out of them, and we brought love to them. And it shifted. It had me no longer be stopped by the things that were stopping me, and instead be empowered and inspired by them.
Right.
And that was when I was able to start making progress with the book and getting the book and its message of love out into the world.
Now, you did write, Love is the Conversation That Erases Fear. Since 9/11, the world has become filled with a conversation of hatred, terror, war, and fear. It is time for us to be responsible for filling the world up with a conversation that will empower us, one of compassion, understanding, wisdom, joy, and love. So, I mean, it's certainly, you know, in line with a form of enlightenment that you feel from within, and certainly the successes that you have had reflects that. I think, you have guidance here in getting your message across. And that brings us to the idea of, the question, I guess, that I have for you is, you chose to go to the self-publishing route versus, getting with a traditional publishing company. What made you decide on that?
Yeah, well, we actually had sent our book out to a few publishers and a few agents, and got a handful of no's. And I was in a class at a time. Now I've become a fan of classes. I started doing some work at the Science of Mind Center, a class on Emerson and Thoreau and Joseph Campbell. And then I was also doing some work at Landmark Education. And I remember one time one of my ministers asked me, is anybody working on a project that they're not getting the results that they want? And my hand went up big and high and waving. And I said, yeah. I said, I have this book, and it's this inspired message I know directly from God of love. And I know that it's meant to be in the world, and, it's not happening. And she said, well, are you willing to do whatever it takes? And I said, what I've been learning is that I need to send it out to 40 publishers and 40 agents and get 40 no's, and then be ready to send it out to 40 more, and then be ready to send it out to 40 more. And I said, no, I said, I didn't think that we had to, kind of like suffer like that in order to get our message out. And she said, but are you willing to?
Yeah.
And I said, all right. I said, I think I get that. I said, I'm going to do whatever I know can be done, and then inside of doing that, other doors will open, is what she kind of promised me. And she was right. I said, all right, I'm going to make a commitment. I don't know what else to do, so I do know that I can send this out to 10 more publishers this week or 10 more agents.
Right.
So I said, I'm going to do that before the next class.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you know that, I really believe that it was the next day,
mm-hmm.
and that in the mail arrived an endorsement from Mark Victor Hansen from Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And we had asked for this endorsement many, many months before and
mm-hmm.
hadn't heard anything.
Mm-hmm.
Probably June, and now it was November.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did we get an endorsement from his office, but the letter that we received said, not only is Mark sending you this glowing endorsement that you can use, but he has also forwarded your book to his agent, which I've never seen him do before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, it was that experience of you don't always necessarily know the right actions to take towards your dream or towards
right.
that project that you're working on or that vision, but
right.
that I believe that the universe likes action. And so it says, go ahead, take whatever steps that you know or can see to take,
mm-hmm.
and then if you're doing your part, you do that part, I'll go ahead and do my part.
Mm-hmm.
And other doors will open up to you. So this this opportunity to possibly work with Mark Victor Hansen's agent came up and the endorsement. And then what happened was his agent called me and said, you've got a beautiful book, but I really don't work with children's books
mm-hmm.
unless you're a celebrity or an athlete. Famous athlete, a professional athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but soon after that, I got on a phone call with a gentleman who called himself the book coach.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you've got all this passion and this great idea and this endorsement. He said,
mm-hmm.
you need to self-publish. I
mm-hmm.
said, self-publish? I was like, said, I don't even know what that is. And he said, you'll need about $10,000. And I said,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what part of, unemployed bartender you didn't hear, but I don't have $10,000. And I like to say that his certainty outruled my uncertainty.
Right.
And he planted the seed in me that, again, didn't even exist before
mm-hmm.
this conversation. And by the end of that day, I had raised the $10,000
mm-hmm.
from a place that I didn't even know that it existed.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that was back to my mother, my
mm-hmm.
my mom, and the incredible depth of a mother's love. My
mm-hmm.
mom was a kindergarten teacher for 38 years, but
mm-hmm.
she has incredible credit. And
mm-hmm.
she was able to extend her credit
mm-hmm.
to us in order to get the book printed. And we just decided to go for it. She said, let's set up a company. Let's get the books printed. And we hired a printer overseas in
mm-hmm.
Hong Kong and then in China and got 3,000 books delivered to our doorstep and had an urgency to sell 3,000 books. And really, like I've shared a little bit with you that
mm-hmm.
there were things that we learned that just resonated like the, like the thing to do. And
mm-hmm.
what we were learning was that it was, difficult to impossible to get your self-published book into a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And then your competition's so huge anyways.
Right.
It was a self-published title. You really wanted to find places where your target market were going
mm-hmm.
to be
mm-hmm.
that weren't necessarily the bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So we got our book into gift shops, galleries, and children's specialty shops across the country, and we ended up selling almost 180,000 copies self-published of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So we really knew that we had something special and that it was meant to be in the world, and that just really fueled the, kind of like the passion and drive
mm-hmm.
to really get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But you guys did a phenomenal job. I mean, from a self-publishing perspective, I mean, you guys really, I think doors were open for you guys to make a tremendous impact. And, of course, the message you wanting to get across certainly speaks for itself, too. But I think the determination that you have behind it, that makes a big difference. But, of course, once you get to that level, you certainly took the success to the next level of success because you did find yourself a publisher to help you to take it to the next level of success. Tell us about that and how has that changed your life?
Yeah. Well, one thing I love to share, because I know that a lot of moms, and actually, you have a book as well, and I tell people that, our book and its message of love is, and you know, and I know that this is why you invited me on your show as well. It's a story of love shared between a mother and a child. There is not one person on this planet that does not have that relationship. Everyone has a mother. So our book and its message is so universal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know that part of our success is that, you know, if you write a book about how to parachute, you have a much smaller target audience than if you write a book about, you know, the message that's in our book. And then the title as well, I Love You More. It's funny, in my family, when people say, I love you, we answer, I love you too.
Mm-hmm.
But I've come to learn that in many, many, many families, millions of families, I would easily guess, when someone says, I love you, they answer with, I love you more.
And so it's
you know, it's a title that just has this really, like, emotional, amazing connection for people. So we knew that the success that we had as self-published was great. And maybe it's the big vision that just kept pulling us towards what's next, because I really believe with every ounce of my being that our book is and its message is meant to be in the hands of millions. In order to do that, we wanted to team up with a publisher who could really get us the distribution into the traditional channels of all the bookstores and book fairs and catalogs and clubs. We did team up with Source Books in fall of 2007. And they re-released our book. We made a few minor changes to, like, the size and just to enhance the beauty of it, and ended up on the New York Times bestsellers list three times the following year, twice around Valentine's Day and once around Mother's Day, which was an incredible gift. So they've really helped us to, you know, have a more mass distribution and get us into all those, again, like those traditional channels.
Well, what you guys did also, I think it gives, when you did that, it just changes you. You are in the situation now, you made another change, because then you had an opportunity to travel as a speaker and as a visionary in sharing your passion of unconditional love and start talking about it and so forth. So some of the places that you've been to, what really get you motivated to go to some places? And I know that you have created a school program that's called Self-Esteem Through Love, Empowering Our Children to Shine. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I feel, you know, what having the book allows me to do is, you know, one, my book and its message, it's now published in Korea as well as in Israel, so it's in Hebrew and Korean, and it's been sold to companies in Australia and then all over the U.S. and Canada. So my book and its message can reach so many more people than I can individually, but what this book really, and especially being a New York Times bestselling author, allows me to do is to travel to schools and to connect with as many teachers and educators, who I love dearly, and children as possible. And it's really a gift to be able to go into the schools. And not only do I share about what it's like to be an author, and I especially share about the editorial process and how, you know, your editor, who in my first case was my mom and my sister, my mother said, the book, honey, really needs to rhyme, because it didn't rhyme at first when I wrote it, and it's got a really beautiful rhyme and rhythm to it. And not every children's book needs to rhyme, but this one really makes a lot more sense rhyming. And my book is a flip-sided book. It starts from both sides and reads to the middle. So, like, love it really never ends. And that was my sister's idea. When I first wrote it, it just went from front to back. And she suggested, if you pull out the mom story and pull out the child's story and have them meet in the middle, it would make a really unique book.
It is unique.
One of the things that I share with the students is that, about the editorial process, but then I also get to share with them some of the life lessons that I've learned, and especially the first one of just be yourself. that it's a lesson that they all learned in kindergarten, but it took me many years to learn how to embrace. So, you know, I share with them what it was like losing my hair and how the kids treated me. And then obviously the message of love and how important that is to me and to the world. And also the ideas of genius, that I absolutely believe that we all have our own unique genius and talent that are almost like innate gifts that are seeds planted in our heart. And then we're here to develop them through practice and learning. And we, you know, we use our brain and the abilities that we've been given here to bring them into the world. So that's what my school program is focuses on.
That's wonderful. That's a beautiful message, because I think a lot of time we don't emphasize that enough at the very young age, because with so many distractions out there, and most importantly, I think the building of that self-esteem that, you know, hey, you can accomplish everything you set forth. And I like the idea of the fact that you talk about the seed of genius in every one of us, because that's one thing that my mom instilled in me, that there's a seed of greatness in every one of us. And so your message is, the irony of it, you know, unconditional love is motherly love, and I love you more. And I talked about the fact that you can never love your mom more than she loves you.
And I believe that.
Unique, and there's a unique scenario, and you talk about going back to your mom after all these years and having her to bankroll your investment, because and I talked about that, about mom being your personal banker, you know. And so it's kind of a unique scenario, all the wonderful things that, you know, and actually what it happens here is that you actually validates what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult for a guy to talk about motherly love, because sometimes people look at me in a different way, and I was like, wait, what happened here?
Yeah.
But anyway, you have a new version of this book out, I Love You More. It's a beautiful version, actually, easy to carry version of it. What's your vision for this new launch, which actually came out this month, correct?
Yeah, it became available September 1st, is the board book version. So the traditional version of I Love You More is hardcover with a jacket. It's a really nice gift book. A lot of people buy the book for loved ones of all ages. So you know, I didn't really foresee that happening at the beginning, but a gentleman would say to me, I need two for my kids. And I'd say, how old are your kids? 27 and 30. They're going to love it. And then, you know, moms would be crying, and they're like, oh, I need, you know, I need copies for my sons, and they're in their 40s. But with this board book version, which is the cardboard version, children, little ones, can have it in their hands, and they, you know, kids love. They love. Well, they, you know, they love to pretend like they're reading, and when you read a story to them enough times, then they're able to read it themselves. And what I have to share is that, last week or 2 weeks ago, I went on a trip with my godson, who's 3 now, and his younger brother, who's 8, and my 2 best friends, and it was a road trip. And I read I Love You More, the board book version, oh, about 100 times, I'd say. Every time that we went to do something else, Zane would say, well, where's your book, Auntie? Where's your book? And so I read it and read it and read it to him, and I would have him help me read it by pointing out the tree, I love you higher than the highest tree ever grew. He would say, I love you, just a bunch of different things. And his mom told me that the other day he picked up the book in the back seat and read the whole book. And so that a 3-year-old, you know, and it's his version of reading, because he's actually not reading the words, but that a 3-year-old can actually hold that message of mother's love and of God's love, because my book can actually be read from the story of a mother to a child, so you can take it to the next level and read it as a message from creator to child, or God to child, and that we're all children, and really just get how loved we really are.
How can someone buy your book and get in touch with you for your services?
Yep. The book is available everywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, all great independent bookstores. But everybody can go to my website, which is my name, Laura Duxta, That's Laura, D as in David, UKSTA.com. And I also really just want to let anybody out there, because I know that we must have some aspiring children's authors out there, or even aspiring authors. And one of the things that I have available right now is that I actually teach a children's author academy to give you an overview of everything that I possibly can share that I've learned inside of the world of children's publishing, which includes writing and editing, publishing, and then also marketing, promotion, and sales. And people can find that at lauraduxta.com/academy. And the next class is actually getting ready to start soon, so people can go ahead and check it out.
Does this apply to other authors also, perhaps, the techniques that you're teaching, or is it strictly maybe more specialized towards children's book writers?
You know what? I the class I set up is specifically for children's authors, but I absolutely consult with and have other programs that are available to – in this program, you could absolutely sign up and participate in and get – just as much from other books, because what we spend a lot of time on is marketing and promotion. I want to say, unfortunately, for some, the creative types, but one of the things that, I kind of learned is that writing your book is about 10% of it. And really, like, the marketing and promoting and getting your message out there is really the other 90%. So it really does work for anybody. And I'll let me give everybody my email address, which you can find also on my website. But let me give you L Duxta. So the letter L, D-U-K-S-T-A, @gmail.com. And you can reach me there, and I can let you know about what services and classes I have coming up. If you are an aspiring author that would like some help getting your book and its message out into the world.
Well, Laura, what can we expect from you in 2010?
We'll continue to be speaking at schools throughout the country. So if you are involved in a school and you'd love to have me come, I've got some different areas that I'll be visiting in 2010. And I also have my next book coming out fall 2010, which is right now a work in progress, working with my editor on the final edits for the manuscript, and then we'll go into getting it illustrated and out there in the world. And it will be an incredible gift book for that holiday season and beyond. It is the working title right now is You Are a Magnificent Gift to the World. And then when you flip it over, because it will be like I Love You More, the second side is The World is a Magnificent Gift to You.
Wow.
So it's going to be a really special message, and we're just getting to
And when is the tentative date of debut?
Probably September, just about this time next year. Yeah, so
next fall.
We don't have the exact publication date yet, but I will be sure to let you know.
Fantastic. Yeah, we would love to have you back and talk about that because, our listeners are moms, women, and family, and that's what we're all about. And so that's wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. As for all guests on this show, do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Yeah. My recipe for living is really goes back to, that message that I am so empowered by, the message of love. So it's to know you are loved and to do your best to find ways to experience this love. And often we experience love when we express it to others.
So in other words, when you give love, you receive love back.
Absolutely. And that's
fantastic.
That's what we're here for.
That's fantastic. That's just a beautiful recipe for living. Laura, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me and from My Mama's Kitchen. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning as we continue with our theme from My Mama's Kitchen Recommends. My guest will be Susan Heim. She is a longstanding author and editor specializing in parenting, multiples, women's and Christian Issues. Her latest books in the Chicken Soup for the Soul series are All in the Family and Devotional Stories for Women, which, by the way, will be coming out and available next week. Susan is also the founder of Twin Talks and has a website which parents share tips, advice, stories about raising twins and multiples. We'll be discussing her life's journey, motherhood, her two new books, Chicken Soup for the Soul, All in the Family, and Chicken Soup for the Soul, Devotional Stories for Women. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my weekly recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Laura, thank you again, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Johnny. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.